Welcome to Beyond Beauty, where we uncover the remarkable stories behind the extraordinary women artists in the world of art and culture. I'm Jacqueline Cofield, your host. Join us as we explore the diverse landscapes of artistic expression, shining a light on the voices that often go unheard and the perspectives that redefine beauty and knowledge. From Nigeria to Brazil, from India to Jamaica, we celebrate the rich tapestry of creativity that transcends borders and challenges conventions. Through insightful conversations and captivating narratives, we invite you to immerse yourself in the stories of courageous women who dare to dream, create, and inspire. Today, we're exploring the transformative power of art and self-expression with Adebumi Badebo, a remarkable artist whose work delves into the themes of the African diaspora, identity, memory, and history, with a focus on using unconventional materials such as human hair and soil from significant sites. Badebo's artistic journey is as unique as it is profound. Join us as we uncover her creative process, delve into her background, and discover the powerful messages she seeks to communicate through her art. Adebumi Badebo, what an honor and a pleasure it is today to see your smiling face on the screen and to be in community with you, to talk about your work. I am so excited. We met at the Metropolitan Museum of New York, where your work was featured in the Hear Me Now exhibition. That show has now traveled to Boston, where it's now at the Museum of Fine Arts, and it's going to continue on to Michigan and Atlanta. I'm just so excited because you are just a phenomenal person. I've got a chance to know you a little bit better, being in a class with you at the Met Museum, taught by curator Adrian Spinozzi, the curatorial practice program, where you decided to join in with the rest of us. And it has just been an honor and a pleasure to listen to you talk. So I'm so excited for everybody to hear you today. So Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. And like in that time of getting to know you and learning just all the amazing and legendary artists that you've had the pleasure of being in commune with and talking with, like, I'm really, really honored to be another artist to that list and to know you in this format. So thank you.
Oh, hugs. Well, I have to say, I love you. Okay, so let's start from the beginning. We're going to go back. Okay. So you are what is considered a young artist because you're under 30.
Well, I'm 31.
Oh, wait, you're 31? I didn't think you were 26.
No, I'm 31. I wish all this stuff I did happened just at 26.
Well, you're still a young artist because any artist under 60 is considered a young artist. Yeah. All right. So you are considered a young artist because you're under 40. You're under 35. Still, you're a young artist. But I want to think back to your time as a student, both in K-12, elementary, middle, high school, and college. How did those learning experiences shape or develop who you are today as an artist?
Yeah, so I grew up in Maplewood, New Jersey. People from Maplewood refer to it as MAPSO, Maplewood, South Orange, are like kind of the two communities that kind of almost act as one. But I was raised by my mother, who's now, she passed away of COVID in 2020, but she was a single mother.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. And she's from Brooklyn. I joke around, I say people from Brooklyn act like it's a state. But she moved to Jersey for law school, and that's how she ended up in Newark, New Jersey. So even though I grew up in Maplewood, Newark was really dear to her. And she often, a lot of the kind of programming I did as a child, she looked to Newark because they had a lot of kind of free program for children. And when I was three, she entered me the Newark Museum, which is now the Newark Museum of Art, had a junior museum, a part of their educational program. And part of like the junior museum, they had classes for toddlers where you could come in on Saturdays and make art with your parent. And at three, my mom had me at the Newark Museum almost every Saturday in these classes. And for the longest, I had like artwork from that kind of period of my life. My mom turned almost every hallway in our home into like mini galleries. So I always say like my art career started at three. People who knew me K through 12 probably know me more for running track. Track and field was like a major part of my family's life. My aunt and uncle are now probably in their like 26th year of, they founded and still run a track team in our community, the Jaguars. So track was kind of like my outward life. Like everyone knew me going to track practice or going to a track meet. And I ran track from like 7 to like 22. But like more privately, I was always engaged and actually longer than my like athletic career in art. So I was in these art programs. And then obviously I engaged in like just the kind of requirements of art classes in the K through 12 public school setting. But my mom, I guess she saw some like innate talent or just interest in art in me. And she really nurtured that. So I think starting in third grade, I took private art classes. There was a woman in our community, an artist named Evelyn Graves, who would give classes. She actually had a career as a private art teacher, but in her retirement, she continued to provide art classes to children in the neighborhood on various days of the week in her basement, which was like her art studio.
I was just about to ask you where. What did she do that?
In her basement in West Orange. So I would every Wednesday for maybe like 5 years of my life, my mom would leave work. She was an attorney, pick me up from school and take me to Miss Evelyn's house. And I think the classes were like 2 hours. And it was like through Miss Evelyn's practice the first time I like learned about Romare Bearden or saw collage and saw mixed media. But we were doing everything from working with clay to mixed media, collage, painting, like the foundation of painting and drawing. So in a way, like those classes were more kind of influential in my artistic development. And then, you know, she made like Kool-Aid and gave us like cookies for snacks and stuff. And my mom did not play like Kool-Aid and all that. So it was like the treat, you know, to have all these sugar.
Oh, she didn't know about that.
No, but I really learned, you know, like how to charcoal drawings and how to like properly kind of use fixative to make sure it doesn't smudge and to preserve it. Like all those things I learned in this kind of private communal art space and setting in Miss Evelyn's basement.
This is all super fascinating because it's making me think about, you know, your mom. She was sort of developing this curricula for you outside of the school space. And I'm wondering, because it sounds so enriched and it's in the community with people that you knew. And I'm wondering, like, if in the schooling setting, you said that it was much more meaningful, the practices that you were learning, the lessons that you were having outside of school. But I'm wondering about what was happening in the school. It wasn't as inspiring, or were there art classes?
Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up, Maplewood and South Orange is the suburb. So we had like, I guess, a decent kind of creative and artistic education. Mm-hmm. You know, like it was a kind of district where it was mandatory for us to like choose an instrument. Like, were we in orchestra and band?
So what did you play?
The cello. I was really small, so I was like, I want a big instrument. And I really loved
So you were carrying this big instrument that you probably fit inside the case.
Yeah. You know, and even I like reflect on that, like when my mom saw I had kind of a talent for that, I was taking private lessons with my like public school orchestra teacher in her home. So I think I had a good education like in that district, especially once I got to high school and I kind of was locking in more that like this is really something I'm passionate about and mm-hmm. think I want to pursue. But my mom seemed to always, like even in that example I talk about with like orchestra, always seemed to like want to supplement kind of the education that I was receiving mm-hmm. in my like schooling with like just pushing that further. Like I remember in high school, especially in your junior and senior year, teachers are really honing in on like developing your portfolio to submit for college applications. And my art teacher at the time, Mr. McKim, who I found out later was also like my art teacher to a former boss of mine, Bisa Butler. We had like the same art teacher, like 20 years of art. But Mr. McKim would teach private portfolio development and figure drawing classes at a community center in South Orange. And so I would, you know, have his class at regular school time and in the night, like starting, I guess the classes started at maybe like 4 or 5 or 6. I would go to the community Baird Center and take his portfolio development classes because she really just, and I don't know if it was like a kind of response to her being a single mother or just my mom always talked about like, you know, she was a lawyer, but she chose like kind of the smaller law firm route because she wanted to be a mother that was when 5 o'clock hit, she was off of work and she was then like involved and present in her child's, you know, life. And she was like a mother to my friends as well. You know, the mom probably with like we never like grew up in a house or things like that, but she was the mom carpooling and taking us to New York and taking us to concerts. Like she was that mother. So I think a lot of it was just her personality and her parenting style. I will say though, like specifically those classes I had with Miss Evelyn, her being a Black woman, what I would say was present in her kind of setting that wasn't in my K through 12 was just learning about Black artists. Like I would say I graduated Columbia High School really only knowing dead Black artists, you know, mm-hmm. and a lot of that wasn't through my school education. It was through, you know, going to the Newark Museum. You know, the first time I saw Ella Natsui's work was at the Newark Museum, and I believe they are the first institution to collect his work. The first time I saw a Romare Baird in retrospective was at the Newark Museum, and it was recommended to me by Miss Evelyn. So that kind of foundation of learning about Black artists was outside of schooling. I don't think we touched on any Black artists, to be honest. And it wasn't until I got to college specifically, I would say more when I got to SVA, because I went to 3 schools for undergrad. And also our program department being in Chelsea was the first time I learned about like all of these Black artists that were living and having successful careers as artists. And that was supplemented with, like I said, us being in Chelsea and, you know, being able to just walk down the street and walk into a Jack Shaman gallery or a Hauser and Wirth and literally see shows of artists or sometimes even bump into artists that I was learning about, you know, in my kind of college education.
Wow. You've said so much that is really poignant. I want to say first, I'm touched because I'm a single mom. And since my daughter could walk, I was like, okay, you can walk. We're ready for museums. So I've been taking her to museums and she's taking classes at the Guggenheim for toddlers. And so I'm just like, oh, wow, maybe I have a little, you know, and she walks around, she tells people, I am an artist, you know, she will introduce herself. And I love when I hear her say that. And I'm like, you know, so it's so refreshing to hear about your mother. What an amazing woman, supplementing your schooling experiences with these like profound, deep learning and culturally relevant learning experiences for you as an artist, as a young person interested in arts. And so hats off to your mom. Do you remember what prompted you to want to pursue a career as an artist?
I know in high school, there's lots of talks, especially once you're in your junior year, you know, like, what do you want to like major in? And at first I was like an architect. And part of that was because, I don't know, like I said, I didn't know really any living artists. I mean, probably Miss Evelyn was, but she was a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Like that wasn't kind of what sustained her financially.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just felt like it's creative. You know, you draw, you make money. Mr. Brady on the Brady Bunch is an architect. like, I guess that's what like artists pursue if they want to make a living. But then I guess when I learned that like you could major in fine arts in college, I kind of went all in and I was like, oh, this is what I want to major in. And I, like I said, I wasn't aware that you could have a career in this probably until I got to college. But I guess the second I knew this is what I wanted to major in and that was possible in my junior year, sophomore year, I just kind of went head first. And luckily, like I had the mom to like jump head first with me, you know.
That's wonderful. Yeah. So you've exhibited your work in several different institutions and your work is now being collected in prestigious collections. What is, in your opinion, your biggest achievement so far? And
yeah, so I guess it's interesting. I mean, I think the obvious one is that I was in a group, like a major group in a historical group exhibition, the show I was in, Hear Me Now, The Black Potters of Old Edgefield, was the first time the Met exhibited work of enslaved people, and especially the company that I was with, not only Dave Drake, but like Simone Lee, Theaster Gates, Robert Pruitt, Woody D. Othello. So I guess like one may be being in a group exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum. It's definitely, I could see the impact of being in a show like that, like kind of the opportunities that have come since being in that show and continue to being in that show. I think one of the coolest things that happened to me, I don't know if people will say it's the biggest, but I was in a show at the Dhaka Art Summit in Bangladesh.
That is cool.
Yeah, as an artist, I don't know, to have your work kind of take you to like Asia and to be in that context in an international show. And it was also an amazing experience to see people from a different part of the world like still be engaged and like move from your work. Like as an artist, that gave me a lot to witness. But it's funny, like I used to write like big goals for like my career. my 1 year, my 2 year, my 5 year goals. And then like I would accomplish them and realize like, oh, these weren't so lofty. Like, as I thought, like, I would have things like, I want to get into a residency, you know, in 2 years or, you know, like thinking those were major things. And I guess at this point, I've kind of relinquished that kind of idea. And I truly feel like the nature of my work being ancestor work, being work that really kind of honors them and has this like reverence for them and stays connected to them. I really feel like just doing that work in general, like they have been the ones that have been blessing me.
Yes.
With these opportunities that one may say are like these major, major opportunities. And I feel like I've seen them more as just divine things that have happened to me, or just like truly blessings, you know, that I almost feel like as long as I do this work, which like I often call like ancestor work, that I don't know, the world of possibilities will open for me, because all these major stages that my work has been able to be exhibited in or collected by ultimately just keeps their story alive. So I just feel like they just be knocking down doors for me, you know?
I believe they do. Yes, that for sure. You talked about travel. So I do want to ask you if you can expand on that, the role that travel has played in your artistic practice.
Yeah. Well, one, like when I was referring to Bangladesh, like that was really major for me, because like I remember a specific moment where a group of locals came in, not even, you know, there was a kind of disconnect in the fact that I couldn't speak Bangla, they didn't speak English, but them just seeing the work, they understood almost everything about it simply through the color blue, because in their country, they have a history of kind of colonialism and slavery and how they were colonized by the British to produce indigo. And so their connection to this color, which to most of us seems neutral, but to me, obviously, my family was enslaved on the indigo plantation. So just through the color blue kind of opened up this world for me to communicate and to connect with people who I couldn't even do that verbally with. So I think that was kind of one example where I saw that how the kind of the importance of traveling and learning about different cultures and communities through traveling, and how art can kind of break down these barriers. And now I guess travel has, I feel like most of my travel has been to South Carolina. The plantation where my family was enslaved in, is in South Carolina. And then also being involved in Hear Me Now, traveling with curators to Edgefield. So most of my travels is, and I'm doing another project in South Carolina. So I feel like most of my travels is to South Carolina, but like I've exhibited in London, and that was also another kind of eye-opening opportunity to see how a European audience engages with my work. Mm-hmm. And I felt like there was an aspect where they really connected with the fact that a lot of my work is through abstraction. You know, lots of these histories of abstraction originated in Europe. So they have kind of a relationship to that style in ways that I find in America, sometimes especially like Black audiences connect with representation because of kind of this burden or lack of representation in these spaces. So travel, especially like through exhibitions, I think has become important for me to understand how different audiences and kind of what their entry point is into the work. And it kind of informs me in, I think, in the studio space, where I gain a greater understanding of what exactly are those entry points.
Mm-hmm. So I experience your work as a sort of meditation, a construction of your identity through the history of your ancestors. What do you discover about yourself through your practice?
Almost everything. So, you know, I would say I grew up with a good understanding of my history and background and, you know, where I come from. But through my art practice, specifically, I guess, through using like Black hair as a medium and thinking about hair as ancestry and DNA and information, I started to look more into my own ancestry and, like, I guess my curiosity about things that I didn't know about my lineage and ancestors became kind of like grew through my own practice. And it led me down, I guess, I'm not gonna say the loophole, but it led me down the road of kind of finding out for myself where my family was enslaved. And in that, at that time, my questioning was just thinking about my relationship to this country. Mm-hmm. And I guess it led me to, well, how did that relationship start? And it started on this plantation, or three, I should say, True Blue Plantation, Lang Syne Plantation, and Singleton Plantation in Fort Mott, South Carolina. And that path led me to a family historian who is now just like a really, really like close family member to me, Jackie Whitmore, who was kind of the steward or the care of a lot of our family's history. And also someone who's been caring for the cemeteries on these three plantations. So I guess the more connected I became with him, the more kind of curious or interested I became in wanting to know about kind of my relationship to this country and kind of that origin. I guess I reflected that the most through my artistic practice.
Mm. You talked about traveling back to South Carolina a lot. And I know, because I've heard you speak before, I know that what you're doing when you're going there is research. So yeah. I wanted to ask you to talk about your research practices, the role that research plays in your practice.
Yeah. So research is foundational to my practice. The first kind of support I ever hired in my studio practice were research assistants and interns, mm-hmm. before like an artist assistant or manager or anything. But for me, research, I say, is the foundation of my practice, because I feel like all of my work is informed by that. You know, usually my process starts off heavily with researching True Blue Plantation or the histories of indigo or the histories of rice cultivation. True Blue is also a rice plantation, or these practices in West Africa or in Nigeria or in Sierra Leone or wherever kind of the work is about, starts off first with researching that like extensively, probably before I even decide what I'm going to make. And for me, that research serves as the kind of parameters in which every kind of decision making I'm doing, whether that's the material that I'm using, how I'm implementing the material, how I'm implementing my process, is all informed by that research.
What does that research look like?
So I guess when I was doing research on my own, I guess part of it started off with just having a name like True Blue Plantation and going into like South Carolina historical records and trying to learn as much as possible about True Blue, you know, going through records of former enslaved owners of True Blue. Unfortunately, oftentimes most research is, especially like around slavery, is archived through their voice and their records and their documents.
The enslavers.
So, yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I remember, you know, beginning or researching a lot of this stuff, I was looking through wills of former enslavers. I was looking at historical maps. I was looking at appraisal lists. And that was kind of the first times I was finding names of ancestors, which was horrifying. And also, I say, like, a miracle that a name, like, I have a name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was listening to oral history projects of South Carolina and, you know, listening through oral histories of Ravenels, which was one of the slave-owning families of my family. And the Ravenels are a major kind of family in South Carolina, even to this day. Mm. So I was doing a lot of that, and it's kind of expanded into hiring research interns. Maya Pill was a research intern for me. Anastasia Warren, a former classmate, and then they became my research assistant, was supporting me at, you know, not just kind of those histories, but also researching like different processes of clay making or different firing techniques. We did a trip to True Blue. I took a trip with my god sister Nichelle Williams and Maya Pill, and we photographed headstones that were in True Blue to kind of create an archive of all of the bodies that are in the space and identifying kind of their geo point location of where they are. So mm-hmm. that research sometimes looks like archiving
mm-hmm.
this history, supporting my cousin Jackie in archiving and documenting and photographing and videotaping the land. Sometimes research looks like trespassing.
Yes, I remember that video you shared in class at the Met.
Yes.
Where you guys, you were like running and there was like another car coming. Yeah.
Yes. So there's lots of physical spaces on True Blue Plantation that my ancestors built. One of them being a church, Jerusalem Church, that's just across the road from True Blue Cemetery. And the first time I went to True Blue Cemetery, we trespassed on the land. I probably shouldn't be saying that, but you know, we trespassed on the land just to get a photographic documentation of this church. For me, that church represented the physical evidence still on this plantation that my ancestors were here,
mm-hmm.
you know, of their kind of artistic expression. It's the evidence of the first institution they built when they became free people.
I don't believe any man-made boundary should keep you from being in dialogue and community with your ancestors. So I don't look at that as trespassing. Yes, absolutely. You are a multidisciplinary artist. You use so many different mediums. You work in so many different forms. How do you make these choices? How do you choose the materials that you're going to use? How do you decide on a particular form that you're going to execute?
Yeah, so when I was at SVA, student SVA, that's when I made the decision to use Black hair. And for the longest, that was my sole material. But that decision came out of response from a moment in an art history class, seeing the painting Olympia by Edouard Manet, which in that kind of moment, it was the first time I saw a Black figure represented in this kind of thousand years of art history. And my professor barely acknowledged this Black woman in this painting, being one of two people in this particular painting. And I guess in that moment, not only did I see how even when represented, we are still erased, we are still ignored, we are still subservient, you know, within this history, I also saw the role of paint as a material in kind of perpetuating this white narrative historically. You know, if one were to study art history or look at art history, for me, it is a history of white supremacy. And because that history is told primarily through the material paint, it kind of pushed me in the direction of, well, what material is me? And for me, like Black hair It's our politics. It's our spirituality. It's our culture. It's our finances a lot of times, but it's our ancestry. It's literally our bodies. So, you know, I made that decision in art school that Black hair would be my material. And since then, it's kind of probably because of like the research that I've taken, expanded to involve indigo and hair dye, blue hair dye specifically, and cotton and soil from True Blue Plantation that I turn into clay, and objects that I have found that have been left behind on these plantations that I use as evidence of their existence. And
do you get any pushback about using hair? Because I have a friend who recently cut his hair, like he had like a big like afro and he cut it down. And I was like, oh my gosh, I know an artist who would love this hair. And he was like, oh, I'm superstitious. So he didn't. So I was like, oh, but I was going to collect it for you. So can you speak about that? Does that happen?
I guess my biggest pushbacks is when I'm specifically going to barbershops. Like I remember a moment of going to Harlem barbershops and like asking for the hair in the trash can. And they was like, hell no.
Why? Why? You know,
like, support your work. I think what you're doing is cool, but you know, and I think some of that is just retentions from our relationship to our hair, pre-slavery, you know, like understanding the spiritual significance that our hair holds. So I always say, like, I'll never ask someone to cut their hair for my work. You know, all the donations have been voluntary, have been people or like barbershops who just feel a great connection with the work. And lots of times it's people who have cut their hair and feel really honored that through my practice, their hair could take on this kind of second life and be kind of shaped and cared for and made into this art piece. And I find that as now my work is being collected specifically by museums, there's this like additional layer where people are really kind of motivated to donate their hair to specifically see their hair, their bodies, an extension of themselves in spaces that have historically disregarded us or excluded us. You know, and I often say, like, it's powerful to have a representation of you on a wall, like in a museum. But I think it's another thing to have you,
yes,
literally,
yes,
on a wall in a pedestal. And so I guess, like, you know, I know which barbershops to go to. That's
yes, yes, I love it. I mean, it just, it's just really powerful when you see it in person. And it does have this sense of aliveness. You know, you almost feel like it's growing, you know, like in my mind, it's like every time I see it, it's like, did that grow a little bit? Is it still growing? Like, you know, it's like the relationship has like enabled like some growth in my mind. But so you have recently engaged in collaborative practices as well, for example, with students from Clemson University. And on your website, you have a section for hair donations. How does involving the public or other artists in your process influence your aesthetic?
Yeah, I think involving the public keeps my practice going. I know the like kind of ideas and things that are in my head, like I have a lot to say, but I think in projects like what I'm involved in with Clemson, I could explain that further, or, you know, receiving hair from the public, it pushes me or it expands my ideas in ways that I can't do by myself. So when someone's donating their hair, within their kind of donation is a letter about why they cut their hair or a story about why they cut their hair. That's something that is outside of me. Then I could kind of take in and reflect in the work, or the project that I'm involved in with Clemson, basically a group of students from Clemson University in South Carolina saw my show at the Met and saw the ways in which I use like the land and soil from cemeteries to honor Black life, Black labor, like enslavement, and figured that I could be an artist to help support them in their efforts to recognize and honor and to make artwork about the 667 Black bodies of enslaved convict laborers, sharecroppers, wage workers, and their families who have been recently discovered on Clemson's campus using ground-penetrating radar that are buried on their campus grounds. And none of these bodies are marked or identified with the proper headstone. They're all right now just marked with a temporary kind of flag to identify there's a body here. But Clemson University, before it was a university, was Fort Hill Plantation. And one of the enslavers had a will that when he died, he wanted his plantation to be transformed into a school of agriculture. And of course, the enslaved population supported that transformation. And then it later became Clemson University and wasn't even integrated into the 60s. You know, so those students coming to me, asking me to help support them in an effort to make an art piece that kind of talks about this history adds to my practice.
Yes.
So it expands even, you know, my work just around True Blue, and it starts to bridge these gaps about these other histories of enslavement and erasure that are happening all over this country that I could be a part of. So I would say working with the public are the legs of my practice that allows me to keep working.
You know, last week I was in Chicago for the AERA conference, and I got to hear, it was the first time I got to be in community with in the same space as Dr. Cynthia Dillard, who I just love her scholarship. And she talked about how this notion of self-care is not really the approach that we as Black people take to caring. We do it in community, you know, so it's like more like community care. And so what you're saying about your collaboration with those students really just brought that up for me, thinking about, and I'm also, the last question I want to ask you is about self-care. So I wanted to ask you, as you work on these several projects and which are really deep and I imagine like quite emotionally charged for you, they're dealing with social and cultural engaged themes, how do you practice self-care? And what would you suggest other artists or other women artists in particular?
Yeah, I love that kind of example that you talked about, self-care and community. I found that like at some point in my practice, I could take better care by bringing people to support me, like in my work, and that it just does better for them, my ancestors, that, you know, my practice looked more communal. But yeah, it's interesting. That question of self-care is one that comes up a lot when I'm like giving talks or something. And I feel like as my practice or understanding of like what this work is expands, that question expands as well. And I feel like at this point of my career, one, thinking about my practice as like spiritual work grounds kind of me in how self-care looks. So right now, self-care looks like, you know, before going to a cemetery, the land of the dead, like truly acknowledging that, you know, giving the offering to the land, you know, thanking the land and my ancestors before I even take anything from this space, like soil or objects or anything, to give something to it. self-care looks like.
Ritual.
Yeah, taking moments of rest. Mm-hmm. I remember specifically, there was one week I was in South Carolina, and in a week's time, I think I visited 8 different plantations and dug soil from 2. And I just felt so heavy. Like in that week's time, I think I entered 3 former slave cabins, you know, and energetically, that's a lot to like be in those spaces, you know, slave cabins, plantations, cemeteries, is a lot. And I think as a Black person in general, like not only just like being in those physical spaces, but driving through, there's this innate kind of energy or presence of warning and danger, you know, that like my Black body is in this space that is just present, like in the car, you know, just driving past a cotton field. Mm-hmm. So care has looked like rest. Mm-hmm. Sometimes care looks like a lot of reality TV, like major, like kind of distractions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes my research requires care, you know, like reading stories of slavery through research could be a lot, mm-hmm. you know, so I guess just taking time, making sure that I'm not doing this work alone, mm-hmm. making sure like spiritually I'm fortified. Mm-hmm. I've recently been initiated to the Yoruba tradition. So now I feel like I have a true foundation of like when I say spiritual work or ancestor work of how to fortify myself and protect myself and clean myself spiritually so that I could do this work. So nowadays care looks like being a Yoruba priest or thinking like truly like acknowledging the spaces that I'm entering and being present to that, I guess.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of us who are always, you know, we just love you so much. And I think some of us, like myself, we ask that question because we want to find ways to care for you, you know, as you so courageously shepherd us in this this journey, this learning journey that you are teaching us all about. And so I'm just so grateful for you. I'm so grateful for your practice. And I mean, you're so young, you have so much to do in the future. So it's just going to be wonderful to watch you, you know, as the years go by and to see all that you're going to do. I'm just so excited to watch that develop. So thank you so much for spending this time with me today on this podcast, Beyond Beauty, where we're really talking about all that is so much profound knowledge and practices that really goes beyond the beauty of the aesthetic that people are experiencing and you know, when they encounter these works, that there's so much deep thought and care and all that that goes into these works. And so I thank you for being a part of this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this insightful conversation with Adebumi Badebo. Her dedication to exploring the intersections of history, identity, and art is both enlightening and inspiring. We eagerly anticipate witnessing her ongoing contributions to the art world and the impactful dialogues they will inspire. Thank you for joining us on this enlightening expedition through the world of women artists from the Global South and its diasporas. We hope you've been inspired by the stories shared and perspectives explored. Remember, beauty knows no bounds and creativity thrives in every corner of the globe. Keep seeking out the voices that challenge, uplift, and redefine our understanding of art and culture. Until next time, stay curious, stay open-minded, and continue to explore the beauty that lies beyond beauty.